Accession number 30063, Reel 12.
Mr. Reed, Reel 12. So you've joined this, I suppose, one of the headquarter units of the SAS, and you said that it didn't always fight as a unit. There may be groups going out from it.
Yeah, there was. You never went out in unit. I mean, if you wanted to use it as a unit, you had regiments in the brigade headquarters. Yeah, the 4th Hussars or whatever they are, and the 3rd Hussars weren't there, sorry. The 4th Hussars. You could have used the SAS as another regiment with 200 people in, if you like.
How many people were in the unit, did you know?
In the SAS?
In the SAS.
I gathered around about 150, I would think. That was including everything, everyone.
It wasn't a large unit as such.
That was the whole reason why it was called the SAS. That was the whole reason that Stirling fought for this thing. This was his dream. This, he thought, was bloody stupid to have 200 men going along with bayonets and trying to kill somebody. He did not want that at all. What he wanted was destroy the stuff that was causing bloody havoc in North Africa, which was German planes coming across and strafing them and killing them in tanks and things like that. And backwards and forwards, the planes were knocking hell out of them. So what was the best way to prevent them doing this? Blow the bloody things up, he said. Now, it's no use sending 200 men behind the lines. Somebody's going to say, hey, they're here. But it's a different matter sending 4 behind the lines in 1 or 2 jeeps. So now you're there and you could go in with 1 or 2 jeeps, and amongst other ways of going in, park the jeeps, leave them there, walk onto the editor room, stick time pencils down in whatever place they are, and blow the whole bloody and leave them time for half an hour or 2 hours or whatever. And the time pencil, away goes, up goes the plane, and that's another good thing done by just 4 men.
And did he inspire you all with this concept, this idea of fighting?
Yeah, yeah. If you didn't want it, if you didn't like it, there was no charge. Get back. You're no bloody good to me. Right?
And did that happen with anybody that you know of? Anyone
not
said
that I know of. No, not that I know of. Certainly not in the first instance.
Was he a hard taskmaster?
He was, yeah. Yeah. I had to do it. If you didn't want to do it, get out. You would never put him on a charge. He would thump you sooner than put you on a charge. Get out. Don't want you. What did you come here for in the first place for? Sort of style.
So you joined them, and you've been told you to look after the wireless. And you got this...
We had no communications whatsoever. None. No communication whatsoever. But bear in mind, as far as I was concerned, and there was other fellows like the guards and tank crews and things like that, I'd been used to being mechanically minded with jeeps, with tanks, with everything. And they, and also with sort of gestures with the jeeps and the men. And they might get 8 men. They might get 2 men. But the norm was about 4 to 6 men, and they could get behind there. Nobody knew who they were. I mean, if there were times when you would be there and the Germans would pass you like that and wave.
Just wave at them.
Mm-hmm. Right? Because it was only the...
Unexpected, wasn't it?
You said you would see them looking, you know.
Yeah, totally unexpected. Yeah. You weren't supposed to be there.
Who are they anyway? Oh, it's all right, leave them. Sort of wave. So with 4 men and with 6 men, whatever, and A, they didn't get the casualties that you would get with 200 men fighting with bandits.
Did you become to feel that you were specialists?
Yes, very much so.
You're better than the rest of them.
Very much so. Insulated. We were. Never went on leave in Cairo. Never went on leave. I can't remember having a leave with the SAS. Can't remember. Didn't have it.
Was it part of also that you were a kind of a jack of all trades? You were expected to turn your hand to anything.
Oh God, yes, pick it up, a sponsor, you know. These were absolutely necessary. You had to have them. The other jeeps with the thing on the stanchion and the twin vickers on and the 0.5. I mean, can you imagine the jeep and sitting up there thump, 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 and thumping away with a 0.5? It is shattering. The poor old jeep is, you know, just talking to bits about. So that was the way that Stirling wanted to fight the war in North Africa. He wanted to hit them where it hurt. And he did.
In your experience, then, this is the role that you are now going into. At what point in time, in the very early days, at what point in time did you get your first action?
We waited for the tanks, the jeeps coming back from ordnance. We had meanwhile got aircraft machine guns instead of Vickers, the aircraft, which were 800 rounds a minute. So the first thing we did was get down to Kufra.
And what kind of a journey was that?
That was one unholy bloody journey. It was rocky desert land. Down to Kufra, it was all right. We got some water and stuff like that, a well there. And then down
How far is it from where you were to Kufra?
Oh, from base depot. I mean, you get from the canal through past Cairo. From Cairo, you then shoot off to go around the south, not the north. Go around the south and then go to Jaro. That's we used to go through the Salt Sea.
The Katara Depression.
I think I mentioned that to you. Used to go through there, and the jeeps would take it okay. That would be in a way down south. Now, that was one of the reasons I couldn't understand it yet, why the Germans never came down and got to Cairo that way instead of having to fight up at Alamein. The Germans could have come round that way, stayed in the Cairo, and that would have been the end. But nevertheless, we got up that way, and the first one was from Kufra. That's a long, long way. I mean, you're talking not just 50 miles or so, you know, hundreds of miles to get there.
And then the conditions for driving, what were they?
Bloody awful. You didn't have a road. No roads. No roads. Maybe a track, if you're lucky. But no roads at all. And then, so you were continually driving between boulders or across soft sand. Keep your foot down, make sure it goes, keep it going. All of this way, you know, of getting there, all the hazards available were there. You think somebody had just got them and said, now then, here's your puzzle, get out of that lot.
And how many days would that journey take?
That would take maybe 3 days, 4 days.
And at what point did you stop?
There was nowhere to stop anywhere. The only reason you stopped, without having the rest, of course, wanting the rest, was to get away into a dump that the LRDG had dropped of petrol and oil and whiskey and rum and rations and gun over and fill your boots.
These were dropped at intervals.
LRDG put these in.
And you must have known where
the map references were there to go, and they were all covered up and camouflaged. And you used to go and just tell yourself.
Night time on the journey, you'd have to sleep.
Night time, you've got to sleep, but you've got to be prepared to be awake as well. Half the time, most of the time, you're awake, or else you were taking over driving for a while, and your partner would nod off, you know.
You'd stop at night for a night's rest.
To make sure that you were out of the way. I mean, you didn't. So once you got up there, and then the idea then was that any column which is straying a little bit would be shut up. And then you had to get out bloody quick, otherwise the whole of the German army were going to be after you. So that was it.
Navigation again. How'd you navigate? And you wouldn't exactly know where these columns were at any particular time. You'd have to go looking for them, didn't you?
Yeah.
And navigation.
Aircraft is the RAF used to have a certain supply of what was happening. The front was moving. They knew that the front was down at Tobruk and we were up at Benghazi. So the people at the front couldn't do anything about it. You're in amongst the soft belly of the army, which was sort of the supply part of their army. And they just didn't expect things like this to happen, because they were there specifically to supply the tanks and supplies everything else.
So being, I suppose, in that almost fixed area of fighting, you knew basically where they were anyway.
Oh, yeah.
At any given time.
Oh, yeah.
But I think you said the RAF, if they spotted something, would they get a message to you?
They could let you know.
And were you involved in that radio communication?
No, not particularly, because we were set for a particular lot down in Kufra, different little units, you know. But those, the getting to... You couldn't go wrong in thinking that aeroplanes were coming from behind where the soft belly was of the, and you could go up and get those planes. You would know that they were there, and you would know that there were 150 planes on the desert. You would know that there was no perimeter. It was just desert. It had been cleaned up a bit, but there was no rails or anything. You just drove on. Do what you've got to do and drive, or else walk on. And just put your pencils in. Put your time pencils in, and that's it.
Yeah, we'll come to that. The presumably, the whereabouts of the enemy airstrips and that would be known to the forces anyway, through intelligence
and
everything
else. They were all up there. Each time you moved and ran, they had to clear a new airstrip. Yeah. And it would probably go about 3 or 4 miles back and had to clear another airstrip and let these planes somewhere for them to land, you know.
So you got to Kufra and then you would be given
you
your...
Then you could pick...
What was your first objective? What was the first thing you did?
The first objective was communication with Cairo, with the base depot down at Thingy-bobby.
And you were in radio contact, were you?
Radio contact with him. So we've arrived, sort of style, whatever they want, you know. And that was it. The operation started from then. You were making your way up to the coast, bang, and get away again.
And were you on these operations?
I went on two altogether.
Well, can you describe those to me, please?
Yeah, well, they were purely and simply from Kufra. Now, Kufra was a bit taking a chance there because it wasn't far removed from the coast, but they never bothered with it, so it was all right. And these were coastal wagons of what's-her-name coming down for the army, coming down to with the supplies of going back empty. They were shot up, and it was easy inasmuch as you just sat there. Or the first one, luckily, along the tar strip, the tarmac strip, which was becoming knocked to hell, where they used to drive up and deliver it, alongside it was soft France. So we're driving along and the twin beakers went and it took them out. There's no question about it. So by that time, you're away. You must be away. Otherwise, the Lysander, that was a little plane with a 100-mile-an-hour thing, would be after you to see
the German Storch risk reconnaissance aircraft. Yeah.
That's
so you
that's what I was in the gun. Yeah.
You yourself on this particular attack would set off from Kufra to where?
Yeah,
do you recall the journey and getting there and preparing for it?
The preparation was nothing. All you wanted was plenty of ammunition, plenty of petrol, and we didn't keep any surplus stuff there. It was all off, unloaded. You went with your bare bones and enough to petrol and stuff to carry on and then get away. So that was what you could get away with. You couldn't get away with anything less than that.
Mm-hmm. And were they kind of an iron ration you were carrying with you, basic ration?
No, that didn't matter. He didn't have anything like that.
He didn't have time to brew up.
He didn't have time to eat a sandwich or anything. You did it, it happened, and you, by God, get away down quick. Now, Sterling, you know, he built that. That was his dream. And he was right, wasn't he?
Well, again, I'm trying to stick to this this first experience of you yourself, personally. I mean, you've been told that you're going out on the, to attack whatever, these vehicles. And I'm trying to get your memories of that actual
action. Well, going there as a radio operator, and the lads, one you can call a gunner, and the other one called a driver. Although the driver was given one machine gun, with two machine guns on the other side, and that was where they used it. Now, I was in the back with them, in the back, in a Jeep, year old one. And once that happened, and you realised how many planes you got, and the situation there with them was, get out quick, you know, there's too many here for us. You've done your job, we've done what we want to do, get out quick.
Driver was something like a fighter pilot, wasn't he? He was driving the thing and firing the guns as he went in.
One hand, driving it and
was this first stray that you were involved in, was it a nighttime job when you got there, when you actually came into contact?
No, it was daytime.
And what were you personally attacking then? What were you on this raid?
That was the road.
That's the road one.
That was the road. So, you know, I mean, to attack the aerodromes, you had to, because it took up a lot of land, so you had to be there early morning sort of style, so as you could see what you were doing. And strangely enough, there was not many guards on at that time in the morning, in the middle of the desert, not in the middle, but up in the coast, and nobody there, pilots, maybe at night, if it was a tea time job, as we called it, pilots would be sitting in the hut they've got, and people like that, and they were all shut up with Paddy Maine and his mum.
You're on this particular raid, you're the one that you're on, first one, you were attacking supply columns coming down.
That's right,
do you recall actually the journey up to and coming across the road and how you felt about it? You know, what were your feelings knowing that something was about to happen?
You're waiting to see if there's anybody around to see you. You've got to sit still. It's no use. If you do see anybody, the enemy, I mean, coming down and they're going to make inquiries, don't move. Just wait till they come in if necessary. If you've got to, put one in them. But normally it was so unexpected until in the end they were beginning to get drifted and said, these buggers are coming down from up there, you know. And this has been happening for donkey's years, that sort of style. Been happening for a long time.
Did you dismount and take your weapons to a spot on the ground
That's what we got. They were stuck up on the stanchion on the ruins. They were always there with the guns up and doing, and strange enough, covered up. I mean, with a cloth to keep the sand out of dust and muck and whatever everything else. But then,
did you recall the actual damage you caused on your raid?
It just seemed to stop. It seemed to stop and swerve off the road, you know, and that was it. I know, there must have been about, I don't know, four or five, something like that.
Or enemy trucks.
But that's as far as it sort of went, you know.
Was the German reaction immediate? Did they bring any aircraft to chase you?
Well, it takes time for them to start looking, you know, they can get an aircraft up there. And then find a spot where you're always going to look for it. So by that time, hopefully we're out of it.
What would have happened, or what did happen in your own experience, if a vehicle broke down in a critical situation like that, or was hit?
Leave him? Walk?
And the wounded? Were you told that the wounded had to be left? Sometimes instructions were given about wounded.
No. If the dead was left, if he was killed, he was left there. If he was badly injured, such as the legs shut up or something like that, he couldn't possibly move, he was left there. And the juries would pick him up, although they didn't like him.
I was going to say, how did the German react to that?
They couldn't... The Germans just didn't like them at all. But I don't think they killed any of them.
Of course it wouldn't be their experience, would it? So coming away from that raid, when you hit X number of vehicles and so on, destroyed them, what was the feeling? Excitement, exhilaration, what?
Still excitement. Waiting for the... good, something achieved, got what we went for, whatever it was.
Were you in radio contact during and after the raid with your base?
Those radios, that was when I really had to start then, and it was getting bigger. Now it was getting bigger, moving from the fours and the sixes and the twos and things like that. It was getting much bigger, and there was more people there. So they wanted some form of contact, and they got it up the phone, but not, I don't think it was. You see, there was too much into it, sort of style. The radio station is supposed to be to send and receive message. Well, that's great and lovely, but they were all over the bloody desert. So it was not good in that respect for a few hours. And the one time we got Lend-Lease here, and they sent over some real crackers, but they were in the back of a truck as high as that and as big as this, 18 cents they were.
Tall as a room.
Bloody big things they were. Great, but you couldn't take those with you behind the lines.
So basically, you set off on the raids, and there was no radio contracts at all. You got your objective. That was get in and out.
That's it. That's right.
Were the Germans able to break into your radio system at all?
No, I don't think so.
Was no danger of that?
No. They just didn't know where they were going to be at next. Some of them did. Well, they did once at Benghazi, when they really caught them there with the pants down. And really, after that, it was communications. One of those lads with a beard on was on the other end, and it was there. The Eighth Army were really, we had not with us, but Stirling and the officers had to report to the Eighth Army what they were doing, where they were going, he didn't like that at all. He didn't want people to know where they wanted to go. He wanted to go and himself and do it, and bingo, get out.
And you said you went on a second raid. Was that a similar one?
Similar, but that was bits and pieces off, that was before anything had been decided about how they were going to deal with the aircraft. That was his main job after that. He had had failures with our own aircraft information and stuff like that. He wanted to get rid of the German aircraft.
So at the beginning,
these bloody Stukas and things were vicious things, and they come at you, they don't miss. They were dead straight on you, all the way down, screaming.
Did you ever come under a Stuka raid yourself?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. When the tanks, that was. When the tanks. They used to love the Stukas used to love the tanks, because you didn't have time to get out of the way.
It's been quite frightening.
All I had to do with the tanks was close down, and by that time, the Stuka was after them. at the Hillingham. That was this. So that's what they wanted to get rid of there. It was so all in. It was all to aid the front lines where they were walking up with the bayonets and things like that.
So the main raids then were on airstrips, presumably, and destroying any aircraft on the ground.
Yeah.
And you didn't get in on any of those raids, did you not?
No. By that time, we had a communication set up between Mina and not Mina, between the canal base and 8th Army headquarters, because Montgomery wanted to know what was going on. And
so were you moved back to the canal base to work the system there?
Yeah, it wanted to get it in, and that's right. Yeah, the there was one set up there in Jallow Way, and that's it. But you know, apart from saying we destroyed 300 planes or whatever it was, I've destroyed 6 planes. That was it. That was closed down. Unless there was anything urgently required, which had to get to them. But normally they went along on a straightforward patrol sort of style, clearing it out.
So can we talk
out the way? Keep out the way of the jerrys. You know.
Can we talk about your role in general terms? What was your main role in the SAS?
It's communications.
Communication. And you were communicating between 8th Army, did you say?
Yeah.
And units going out from your own SAS.
They were out there. And they eventually, I'm sure eventually, not very long after, they got bigger, you know. And there was no longer the twos and fours going out, but they had grown now to quite a mob, maybe 12 or 18 of them going out and attacking from different ways and making sure they did a good job of it.
Had the radios improved from the 9 set that you had?
From the 18 sets.
18
that
sets.
Was working to Cairo also there, but that was in between raids. No, they still had the 11 set, but the 11 set, that's the one that I said was small on the back of a jeep. That was okay between 8th Army headquarters and the set itself, you know. So that was the going of it. And don't know, they say reports were, and I don't know how far this is true, 400 odd planes destroyed.
And you'll be sitting in the middle of this, listening to all this coming in and sending it out.
Yeah. Well, by that time, they got sophisticated with the communications and had got cipher clerks in, or one cipher clerk, not clerks, one cipher clerk to encode and decode and send message back. And that's where we used to rely upon this fella to get our information from. Otherwise, there was nobody else there to get it. That's why they've got nothing on the SAS, on the first SAS. They've got no information whatsoever. And that's probably what they want it now for.
So how long would you be with the active SAS unit?
Well, with that one, it would probably be in about 18 months, but the SAS overall, by the time we went to Sicily, Greece.
Now we've got that to come to.
You've got that to come to. That was all. So overall, my overall stint in the Middle East would have been 1941 when we arrived out there to 1945, my stunt would have been about 3.5 years, 4 years.